The Flying Sikh, the story of a World War One fighter pilot, flying officer, and I hope I get this right, Hardit Singh Malik. The Flying Sikh tells the unique story of the only Sikh airman to fly with the Royal Flying Corps and the RAF during the First World War. It's a remarkable account of one man's struggle to enlist against discrimination and then his service as a fighter pilot over the battlefields of Flanders. It is the subject of a new book by Stephen Barker. Delighted to be joining me live on the line, Stephen himself. Stephen, good morning to you.
Good morning, Giles. Great to be on your show.
Good to have you with us. We know about the heroic exploits of Sikh pilots and those from the Indian subcontinent, should we describe it, Indian, Pakistan, etc., during the Second World War. But I was unaware of pilots coming over from there during the First World War. Give me a little bit of background to this, please.
Yeah, during the period before the First World War, increasing numbers of students were coming to Britain to study, either to join the Indian Civil Service or to join undertake studies to do with the legal profession. And of course, they were British subjects. It's a key part of this, that they are British subjects, part of the empire, and quite a number of them. When war breaks out, they want to be recruited into the British Armed Forces. The India Corps has not yet arrived on the Western Front, and in any case, they want to join Britain's Armed Forces as British subjects. And they face one or two problems. We might touch on that in a minute. Well, Malik is one of those because he has been to the University of Oxford and a public school. He has friends in high places and is able to join the Royal Flying Corps in March of 1917.
Just describe what the Royal Flying Corps was, because it is the precursor, isn't it, to what we now know as the RAF?
Yeah, it is indeed. Yeah, it's important to remember that flight is in its embryonic form. You know, the Wright brothers take off in 1903, and the Royal Flying Corps, Britain's military response. People have started to see that there's a military use for aeroplanes, and it all happens very quickly. So the Royal Flying Corps is formed in 1912 and immediately goes to war under a chap called David Henderson in 1914. And as you say, it's mainly the Royal Flying Corps that undertakes the First World War in the air on Britain's behalf. It then morphs into the Royal Air Force on the 1st of April 1918, as you quite rightly said.
So coming over to the UK as a 14-year-old, going to public school and then going off to Oxford, you would assume that, you know, when a bright young chap such as this wants to volunteer to be a flying ace, he would be welcomed by open arms by the Royal Flying Corps. But that didn't happen, did it?
No, Malik attempted to be recruited five times. Actually, at Balliol College in Oxford was a recruiting office that recruited about 800 soldiers in the first 2 weeks of the war, and Malik was not one of them. But why was that? Well, if you were a member of the Indian Civil Service, you were treated relatively equally. If you were a member of the judiciary, you could also attain the highest rank and status. But in the Manual of Military Law of 1914, anybody who was of colour was classified as, and this is the language of the time, as either an alien or a native. And it was entirely associated with your colour. And so Malik, arriving at the recruiting office, you can imagine with a sergeant, there's no hiding the fact that you're an Indian and therefore you are persona non grata under British military law.
So if I'm correct, did he go to France? Did he try and enlist in France? Or was it the ambulance, the Red Cross? What was his next move then?
Yes, it's entwined this with his time at the University of Oxford at Balliol. His tutor, a chap called Sligger Urquhart, is appalled by the fact that Malik can't be recruited. And Sligger Urquhart himself is on the trustees of the Red Cross. And he senses Malik's frustration and enables Malik to go and serve with the French Red Cross down in Cognac in France. But it's not really what Malik wants to do. He wants to be a soldier like his peers. his British peers. He's left at Balliol, empty corridors, empty tuition rooms, because his peers have gone off to war and he wants to join them. It's the second best option. And while he's in Cognac, he's given a hint that he might be recruited, not into the Royal Flying Corps, but into the French Air Force, the Aeronautique Militaire. And basically, his tutor back at Oxford writes to the RAF, and writes to the Royal Flying Corps at Whitehall and says, look, the French are going to recruit one of our British subjects. It's appalling. That's absolutely unbelievable. And how will that look to the world if one of our allies is recruiting one of our subjects? And so it is. He's given an interview in Whitehall and then able to volunteer.
Because, I mean, the Sikh has you know, the Sikhs have a very proud military tradition as well, don't they? Let's not forget that.
Yeah, they do. Much of that is retained from what's called martial law theory. And that is that the British, as part of their colonial engagement in South Asia, had decreed that certain races, certain ethnic backgrounds were more predisposed to military service than others. And it's paraphrasing a little bit, but the Sikhs were definitely that group, came under that umbrella of a martial race.
If you think of Gurkha, for example, you've got Gurkhas as well who'd come under that.
Yeah, and Rajputs, yeah, and so on. And therefore, it's a little bit easier for him to be recruited under that banner.
I can see one problem with this is because being a Sikh, he will be wearing a turban, and your average flying helmet of the day wouldn't be able to accommodate a Sikh gentleman wearing a turban.
No, indeed not. The current Sikh members of the armed forces, it's just not a problem. You know, they attain to the highest rank. But in 1917, Malik comes across a sergeant, for example, on the parade ground at Aldershot, who basically says to him, "Where is your hat?" And Malik says, "This is the headgear of my faith, and I must wear a turban." And the serious part of this, the very serious part of this, is that because Indians are now needed to be recruited in small numbers, special dispensation is worn. But nevertheless, Malik is forced to wear adapted headgear to put over his turban. But he hated it. He hated it. There are no photographs of him wearing that adapted flying helmet with goggles over a turban, because it would have looked outlandish. And I think when he was flying in Italy in 1918, I think he abandoned it and wore a turban. And the other flyers, and his certainly CO, turned a blind eye to the fact he was wearing a turban in the cockpit, because a bound turban is actually probably far more effective at protecting the head than is an extended leather helmet.
So when he got into the Flying Corps, did he experience any sort of discrimination, you know, being of standing out as he did, or was he accepted by his peers as one of the chaps, or, you know, was it so entrenched, the feeling that, you know, obviously the whites were superior and it was the empire and he was almost a token and a bit of a curiosity rather than did they take him as a serious flyer?
Yeah, I think throughout his war service, he was taken as a serious flyer. He loved his service in the Royal Flying Corps, and in fact, when he heads back, he anticipates joining the RAF again. But no, he doesn't mention that he faces discrimination from colleagues at all. He's one of those men, alongside many other soldiers from various parts of the empire, who are serving Great Britain in its hour of need. So Canada, Australia, South Africa, and in the 28th Squadron that he joins initially, it's full of Canadians, and there's actually tension between the Canadians and the Brits. actually in that squadron on the ground. They're great in the air, but on the ground it's a toxic atmosphere, and Malik would have had to tread a balance in that, in those relationships.
In terms of the actual flying then, I mean, is it as we would say, combat missions? Is it flying over and lobbing hand grenades? Is it reconnaissance? Is it, you know, those dashing sort of air-to-air knights of the air battles that, you know, we think about, you know, the Red Baron, etc.?
Yes, exactly the latter. You know, he's in a SOC with Camel, which is a state-of-the-art fighter. From September and October 1917, he's flying in the Battle of Passchendaele. He shoots down, he claims a couple of German victims. And literally, the tactics of the time that he is taught in training is to get up very close. I'm talking about within 50 yards of an enemy plane, pointing your Vickers machine gun and let off almost the whole barrel into the enemy plane. It was a miserable, dangerous, terrifying activity to undertake. And of course, what many people don't realize is that there are no parachutes in the Royal Flying Corps during the First World War.
I mean, if you've seen the film Aces High, for example, you will know how ridiculously short the lifespan was expected of a new pilot. Yet he survived. And as you said, he was flying in was it Italy you said he was down in?
Yeah, on the 26th of October, he undertook a very dangerous mission at Passchendaele. They were in pursuit, actually, of Richthofen, the Red Baron, but came up against another squadron. And it was there that he was involved in an amazing dogfight with his flight commander. But he was shot down on that day. His plane was recovered near to Ypres. It got 450 bullet holes in it. Two of them had gone into his leg. And the surgeon actually felt that they were best left in because the bullets had gone through the lower half of the petrol tank, been cauterized by the petrol, and then they were left in up to the point of his death in 1985. Those bullets were still in there, and actually those bullets had gone through the top half of that petrol tank where the fumes were. I wouldn't be telling you about the same story now because he would have been killed immediately in that instance. But yeah, he's wounded on that day, 26th of October, over Passchendaele, and recuperates in London. And meanwhile, the Italians who are Britain's allies in the First World War, have taken a real battering at Caporetto in November of 1917, and Malik's squadron is sent to Italy. And then Malik is sent to rejoin them after recuperation. And he flies with them for about a month. And your listeners might be interested to know, his war ends as a combat fighter pilot because he was allergic. He became terribly allergic to castor oil, which lubricated the Sopwith Camel's rotary engine. There had been signs of it over Passchendaele, but it had become insurmountable for him to continue. I won't explain to your listeners exactly what that entails, but it was a horrible allergy to have for a pilot, and he did not want to be sent home. He did not want to leave that squadron, but he joined 141 squadron at Biggin Hill in London as a result of the allergy, and he was then attempting to deter German heavy bombers from bombing London in the first London Blitz, which took place during the First World War, not with Zeppelins, but these huge Gotha bombers. And Malik was on fighter duty, but flying a different aeroplane.
After the war, he survives the war. And rather than sort of fade back into, he was never going to fade back into obscurity, was he? Let's face it. And he it's a fascinating time for him to go into, you know, to be involved in, you know, the emergence of Indian nationalism. He obtains high office, isn't he? As India develops as a nation.
Yeah, as I mentioned earlier, originally he wanted to join the RAF back in Britain, but for what it's one of the unknowns that I couldn't solve when writing this book. He changes his mind on the way back, joins the Indian Civil Service, goes back to Oxford for the probationary year for the Indian Civil Service, and in 1922 goes back to India and as part of the diplomatic service and has a long diplomatic service, becomes, for example, the first trade commissioner to Canada and then to the United States, and then the first Indian ambassador to Paris after partition, appointed by Nehru. He was quite close to Nehru. They'd had a similar educational background, at ease in Western company as much as Eastern company.
Interesting that he went to Canada, wasn't it? Because obviously he'd served with Canadians, as you mentioned before, early in the interview.
Yeah, and he looked in that role as the trade commissioner in the mid-1930s. He did look up some of the former pilots who'd been in 28 Squadron. The one that he really wanted to get in touch with was Flight Commander and then later Major William Barker. And Barker remains to this day the most decorated Canadian soldier of all time. I'll just tell you, listeners, actually, Military Cross and two bars, DSO and bar, and VC. I can't see that ever being beaten again.
That's not a bad tally, is it? Let's face it.
It's not a bad tally. And Barker was, Malik was one of his flight crew. There was four flyers in a flight within an RFC squadron. And the sad thing is that Barker was killed in a flight accident in Ottawa in 1930, and Malik greatly regretted his premature death.
So why isn't Malik better known then? Because as I said before, we know about the heroics of the pilots in the Second World War, but I'm not saying he's been airbrushed out of history because of his record afterwards, his distinguished record afterwards. But in terms of those who fought in the First World War, do you think we don't give enough sort of, there's been enough written about the fight, and especially written about Malik?
I think one of the reasons that I wrote this book is that he'd written an autobiography that was published in 2010. He was very reticent about doing so for all sorts of reasons, I think. But he did so with the support of his daughter. It was published in 2010, but very limited circulation in India. One other Indian writer, Somnath Sapru, who died recently, sadly, he also produced a very short memoir about Malik, one of five Indian flyers. It's a story which is very important. Not only are there very few reminiscences from the 1.5 million Indians that served on behalf of the empire, and by the way, listeners might be interested to know that the nearest other Dominion force of a comparable size was the Canadian at 425,000. And of course, we know about Anzacs and Canadians and that. 1.5 million Indians served on behalf of empire during the First World War. And what's important about the book is that there are very few testimonies from any of those Indians. And Malik is even more unique because, of course, he was one of the Indians who enlisted in Britain and served as part of Britain's armed forces. So his voice is doubly unique. And I agree with you that that is a story that needs to be told and has been told now.
How did you come across him then? How was your interest with him piqued? I mean, had you known about him before then? Was it just a chance encounter? Was it, you know, something in a history book or something in a research? How did it come across?
Yeah. I'm a museum consultant by trade, and some of my work, about half my work, relates to military heritage, particularly the Great War. And to cut a long story short, about 12 years ago, I was looking to diversify the stories of the First World War. That in Britain, what do we know about the First World War? We know about the trenches. We know about mud and rats and lice. And actually, the First World War was, as it says on the tin, a global war. And if you take it as a global war, then the Indian contribution comes into play because they're in Iraq, they're in Kenya, they're in Gallipoli, they're in the Middle East, also on the Western Front. Much of their story is beyond the Western Front. And so in answer to your question, I was developing exhibitions during the First World War centenary, and Malik's was a great story, mainly because it was an Oxfordshire-related exhibition, and Malik was at Balliol, used to cycle around the countryside in Oxfordshire, you know, and was well-known in the city. And I expanded that story out. And I also, as I was reading his memoir And doing a little bit of research about him, I realised that there was a much bigger story, which your listeners will need to read the book to find out what that bigger story is, of course.
Well, we look forward to doing that. It is a fascinating story. And as you said, it was a world war, and there's so much more than just trenches and rats. You know, there's the German East Africa, et cetera. And you can get the whole situation there. And as you said, the Mesopotamian conflict as well. But that's a subject of several more interviews, Stephen. We could be talking about this for ages, but I'm going to run out of time. So if people want to find out more information about Malik the Flying Sikh or about yourself, where can they find you?
I'm available on Twitter. My handle is at dstephen with a PHB, at dstephenb. But if you type the Flying Sikh with my name into Google, that will bring up either the Indian version, which is Lion of the Skies in India, or the British European version, which is the Flying Sikh. It's on Amazon or on Pen and Swords website.
And it will, of course, be available as a virtual download from our own virtual bookstore. I like Lion of the Skies. That's absolutely superb. I do like that. It sounds absolutely brilliant. The book is called, in Europe, it's called The Flying Sikh. It's by Stephen Barker, who's been speaking to today. Stephen, thank you so much for your time today.
Thank you very much, Charles. Lovely to talk to you. Thank you.